Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
So here in the studio tonight, we have Cindy Jaconette. Cindy is a friend of Donna Hutchinson, who died of pancreatic cancer. So Cindy and Donna's husband decided to use their bereavement to find energy to found an event, Raising Voices for Pancreatic Cancer Support. They did this with the help of the Santa Cruz Cancer Benefit Group.
So Raising Voices for Pancreatic Cancer Support. Dr. Dawn, thank you for being here tonight so we can increase our visibility and we can let people know about this wonderful event.
I'm going to stop you so I can introduce our other guest, and that is Michael Alexander, Dr. Michael Alexander. Michael is the medical oncology director of the Solari Cancer Center at Dominican Hospital. He's a retired oncologist and an emeritus assistant professor at Stanford.
Thank you, Dawn. Thank you very much, and glad to be here and try to add what I can to the discussion.
Well, thank you. Cindy, go on and tell us about this wonderful event.
So obviously, I'm very enthused about this event and want to share this. November is Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month, and we use this event in Santa Cruz to build awareness, but also the four pillars of this month, which is celebrate, educate, participate, and dedicate. A good friend of mine, Peggy Flynn, at the Women of Courage event said, "We celebrate to stop, to be an antidote to despair, fear, and sadness." And so in this vein, we're doing this event at Bargetto Winery, and it's on November 20th, November 15th. November 20th is World Cancer Pancreatic Cancer Day. November 15th, Saturday, 2 to 5. And at this event, we are going to be very happy to welcome Dr. Dawn Motika as our speaker, keynote speaker, and she shares latest research. She also shares ways we can support each other. The center of this event also is Uma Dobia, who's a sensational singer from Australia. Her father and her brother live in Santa Cruz, and everyone who went to the event last year says, "Are you going to have her back? You're going to have her back?" Yes, okay. So she has an eclectic repertoire, including opera and Zero Gravity from Eurovision and show tunes. And she really brings her love of what she is sharing to us. And she's donated her time each year to sing and raise awareness and funds. It is a fundraiser. So we do have appetizers and we do have desserts and we do have mocktails this year in the vein of healthy beverages. And Bargetto also has its beverages available for purchase. We have, in addition to Uma, her accompanist is Marina Thomas. If you are in Santa Cruz, you know Marina Thomas. She's amazing as the pianist who brings the voice to people's hearts. And opening our evening, we have Mao Mao Liang, and he is a pianist, and we're very happy that he is our opener. We're our sponsors, as Dawn said, is the Santa Cruz Cancer Benefit Group. So it's amazing to live in Santa Cruz, a community where we thought, how do we get an event like this to happen? And somebody recommended them, and they said, "Sure, we'll, you know, help support you. We'll sign the papers you need to make this event happen." We are just so grateful that in our community, this organization is front and center in helping support people with cancer in our community. And our other sponsor is Diane Borison. And Diane Borison is a lovely 19-year survivor of pancreatic cancer. And she's a sponsor because she wants to share the hope that she brings and also to build awareness. And we encourage people to wear purple to this event. That's our color. And it's just a beautiful time of community and a beautiful time of celebration.
All right. Now, you mentioned, Michael, I'd like you to tell me more about this very special organization, the Santa Cruz Cancer Benefit Group. You're on the board, I understand.
I am on the board, and it's interesting that you mentioned people who knew someone or had a relative or friend whose lives were touched by cancer, because the Santa Cruz Cancer Benefit Group started 30 years ago. Five guys in Santa Cruz who had family and friends who had been touched by cancer. And realistically, it's hard to find someone who doesn't have a friend or a relative that had cancer. It's the second commonest cause of death in America today after cardiovascular disease. And so it's very common. The group and the events are virtually all volunteer. So the only overhead is a little bit of infrastructure. We donate money to cancer-related organizations all in Santa Cruz. All of this money stays in Santa Cruz County. We fund some basic research at UCSC, and in the past we funded women care, we funded melanoma screenings for surfers, we funded prostate cancer support groups, and it's about $15,000 a year to each of these groups that we donate. And so it's a way of giving back to our community in ways that support cancer-related services in our community. I'm also involved at the CATS Cancer Resource Center, where some of that money goes, and they provide a credible list of cancer resources and support services without charge for anyone with cancer in Santa Cruz County.
And that's really amazing. I do think, as you say, this is just a sample of the community spirit that we have here in the Monterey Bay area. Talk to us a little bit about pancreatic cancer and its detection.
So you mentioned earlier, you know, is it a bad cancer? And I think most doctors and oncologists would say, yes, this is a bad cancer. Not that there are good cancers, but there are some that are not so deadly or quickly deadly as this one. The five-year survivals for pancreas cancer are roughly in the range of 10 to 15%. So the vast majority of people die from it. And one of the problems is our ability to detect it early. It is very difficult to screen for. There are screening programs, but it's not the kind of thing that we would put people through unless we knew for some reason they're at high risk to develop the disease. So there are certain people that we will screen. The BRCA mutation, which is the commonest breast cancer mutation, which is associated with breast and ovarian cancer, is also associated with pancreatic cancer. And so especially with BRCA2, those patients often will go into pancreatic cancer screening programs. Those programs are complicated. They involve blood tests and examinations, but CAT scans and also endoscopy, putting a scope down into the stomach and through the stomach to the duodenum and visualizing the pancreatic duct. And so that is a complicated undertaking, and we can't pull people in off the street and start doing that, but people who are at high risk, we could do that for and do that for. Many of those programs are experimental, but Stanford has a pancreatic screening protocol that they use. There are other associated causes of pancreatic cancer, cigarette smoking, alcohol. There's a syndrome called Lynch syndrome, which is primarily associated with colon cancer, but can be associated with a number of other cancers, including uncommonly pancreatic cancer. And so those patients will undergo routine screening also. That being said, it's not a disease that we're very good at finding early. And even when we think we found it early, still the vast majority of those people will die from the disease. So it is a disease that is garnering increased interest. I just listened to a talk this week about a new physician coming to Stanford from Memorial Sloan Kettering, who's involved in researching and trying to figure out how to screen and getting an earlier leg up on pancreatic cancer. But so far, it's been very difficult. It's not an uncommon disease, about 65,000 cases a year in the United States, but it is almost universally fatal. And in my career, which was 39 years as a practicing oncologist, I can only think of two cured pancreatic cancer patients that we had. So it definitely is what we would call a bad cancer.
I was struck by one statistic that I saw, that it's 3% of cancer cases nationally, but 8% of cancer deaths.
Right.
There are certain things about pancreatic cancer that make it resistant to most of the therapies we have. I believe that one of them is a sort of tumor microenvironment that impairs the penetration of the chemotherapy drugs. I read about that last year. And I know that we certainly see with solid tumors the ability of the cancer cells to mask themselves or to downregulate the T cells, so that the T cells are just not very active. They're in kind of chill mode. They're not in war mode. And yeah, of course, we want them to be in war mode because they should be making war on the cancer cells. And this immune checkpoint inhibitor technology, I think, addresses that dial and turns it back up. We're still figuring out how to use this drug. It's something we've talked about on the show. Would you care to comment about immune checkpoint inhibitors? And so far as you know, are they used in pancreatic cancer?
The immune checkpoint inhibitors have not been very successful in pancreatic cancer, so they certainly are not a part of the standard therapy. This Lynch syndrome that I mentioned is a disease where there is a deficit in fixing mistakes in our DNA, and as a result, those patients get a ton of mutations. Those diseases can be dramatically responsive to the immune checkpoint inhibitors, and if you're lucky enough to get a pancreatic cancer patient who has that genetic disorder, and at Dominican, everybody who has pancreatic cancer gets tested for Lynch syndrome. There are some dramatic responses and perhaps even cures. We had a case at Stanford where the patient had this, was treated with an immune checkpoint inhibitor, and everything went away as best we could tell. We were so worried that we offered the patient radiotherapy and chemotherapy, and he said, I think I'll stick with what I've got now, and continues to do fine as far as I know. I haven't had input regarding that patient recently. But only for that little niche are the checkpoint inhibitors useful at this point. And there's a lot of research trying to figure out why are not the checkpoint inhibitors working for every kind of cancer. And so there will be expansion of their uses. Whether or not they'll apply to pancreatic cancer, I don't know. Not so far, for the
Great.
Most part.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank both of you for coming in, and it's been my pleasure to give you some airtime to spread the word so that we can all raise our voices for pancreatic cancer.
I'm just going to shout out this website one more time, though.
Oh, go for it.
It's Santa Cruz Cancer Benefit Group, S for Santa, C for Cruz, C for Cancer, B for Benefit, G for Group, .org/events.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'll be seeing you on Saturday the 15th. I have an email that just came in. This is Carrie in Soquel. I just found out that my son's father died from colon cancer and that his brother also had it. When should my son start getting checked for this condition? He's 56 now and is half African American. Does that have anything to do with it? Like, is there a higher or lower risk of colon cancer among ethnic groups? Thank you very much for your program and for sharing your knowledge and expertise as a whole medicine practitioner with us. Your program is really a valuable resource for the community. Well, thank you, Carrie. So let's start out with your son. He's 56, and he's half African-American. So that does put him at increased risk. African-Americans do get colon cancer a bit more often. I don't have the statistics at my fingertips for you. But yes, there's an increased risk. Also, we are seeing colon cancer at younger and younger ages. It's really quite frightening about that. And so I think that he basically should get it about 10 years ago. So let's get it now. There are several ways to screen for colon cancer. When you have a family history like this and a person who's not been checked before, I would recommend a physical colonoscopy where the tube goes up and like a little periscope looks around, because the thing that we really want to know for your son is, does he make polyps? Is he a polyp maker? And some people, sort of like freckles or all sorts of things that run in families, red hair, white streaks, you know, stuff like that. It does, you know, run in families to a certain extent, and so we consider that an additional risk factor. So if he makes polyps, then the polyps will be biopsied and they'll be checked to see if they have any precancerous characteristics. If the polyp is adenomatous, then he probably would want to get screened in another 3 years and then another 5 years after that, and possibly on for several five-year intervals. Now, colonoscopy is not that big a deal because you're sedated and you sleep through it. The hard part of colonoscopy is just getting yourself cleaned out, and that involves effectively drinking something that gives you diarrhea. Not your best idea of what to do on a Sunday, but definitely better than having a curable cancer turn into an incurable cancer. Unlike the pancreatic cancer we've been discussing earlier in this program, this type of cancer is curable, very curable, if it's found early or in the precancerous stages. And since we started doing colonoscopies and flexible sigmoidoscopies, about 40 years ago, they started to be done, and they became sort of standard of care in the mid-90s. And we have seen a drastic drop in death from colon cancer, very substantial, 30%, 40%, something like that. So it's a big deal. And we are now seeing younger people getting cancer. So definitely encourage your son to get tested. Other things your son can be doing for the rest of his life, unless he has a history of ulcers, I would recommend a 200 milligram ibuprofen every day. A high fiber diet, particularly high in colored vegetables. Things like blueberries and orange and red vegetables contain compounds that reduce the risk of cancer. They are antioxidants, so they reduce oxidative stress, which we think of cancer now as a multi-hit disease. A single cell has to have multiple mutations before it becomes cancerous. So if we can put, like you would put sunscreen on to avoid a sunburn, we can put this sort of vegetable sunscreen, or more accurately, it's a vegetable shield against oxidative stress and free radicals, which are little oxygen molecules bouncing around and pinging on things the way sparks flying up from a fire can burn a hole in your couch. So you don't want that hole. Don't have a screen on your fire. It's exactly how these things work. So there's a lot of good information, but a diet rich in fruits and vegetables, and the ibuprofen, actually just one a day at 200 milligrams, has definitely got a track record for reducing the population risk in people who take it. And I think it's worth the risk, particularly with two family members. There may be other things he can be doing, but off the top of my head, those two are pretty easy and pretty important. I have a couple of emails that I wanted to share with you. This is from a regular emailer for many years, Shaul in Israel. Shaul writes, "Hi, Dr. Dunn. My son, age 38 and healthy, but they found he had cancer." So I'll skip through a lot of the medical stuff here, but rectal adenocarcinoma, moderately differentiated. His stage is locally advanced disease without distant metastasis. So he does have some positive nodes. He has microsatellite stability, which is good. That means that the cancer is not as aggressive as it might be. But he but the actual mass itself was good. And since he has additional activity in his lymph nodes around there, we know that the cancer has been stopped, hopefully, in the lymph nodes, but those lymph nodes need to be coming out before they fill up with cancer. So he will be getting surgery. So he's not really eligible for the PD-1 immunotherapy. That would be the immune checkpoint inhibitors, because of certain technical factors that Shaul cites, but I can't explain them to you. He may be considered for clinical trials or personalized cell-based immunotherapy, but he's going to get standard therapy first. Personalized cell-based immunotherapy will be some version of either T cells or antibodies, sort of cancer vaccination therapy. And so, Shaul's questions. Suggestions to support him, his treatment, foods or supplements or other things. And it depends on where you are in the treatment cycle, Shaul. The sorts of things that we would do early is necessarily different than what we would do later. If a person is on chemotherapy, there are some basic dietary recommendations that would be useful. And again, diet high in fruits and vegetables also works for treatment. So using a juicer, and of course in Israel you have access, you've got a year-round growing season, you've got access to fruits and vegetables. So trying to get at least 10 different fruits and vegetables every day, I know it sounds like a lot, almost impossible unless you juice them. So that might be a good present for your son, would be an electric juicer. It's another thing that can be helpful during chemotherapy is melatonin. And so you can use doses of about 20 milligrams a day. It doesn't cause pineal downregulation, so you don't get drowsy from it. But there was a research project looking at melatonin combined with a standard colon cancer therapy. This was about a couple of decades ago, but it did show synergy. Vitamin D, just extra vitamin D, can be really helpful. And I want to emphasize glutamine. L-glutamine is an amino acid, but it is the primary food for the bowel, and so it helps with healing. And it is also a primary nutrient for lymphocytes, so it helps those T cells. DHA, a form of fish oil, can help chemotherapy to work. And green tea actually inhibits oncogenes, and so this enhances certain things. There's also an herb called astragalus, which can be put in soup or used in rice. It's been shown to increase the phagocytic activity of monocytes and macrophages, and it increases natural killer activity. And of course, always mushrooms. So water extracted mushrooms with different kinds of beta glucan. I recommend rotating from one mushroom, water extracted mushroom formula to another. Some people just eat a lot of mushrooms. I think that's fine. The maitake and the shiitake are probably some of the best ones. And when you're treating cancer, there are lots of supplements that can be used to treat side effects. But if you're just looking for synergy, then that's where I would start. as far as the radiation that he'll probably be having, the glutamine is also really helpful for protecting mucous membranes against burns from radiation. So I hope that is helpful for you. And I'm so sorry to hear this bad news. I feel almost like I know you. You're an older man. I think you're in your late 70s now and always asking me questions about how to stay healthy. So I really appreciate you, and I hope I've been able to help you and your family. And that brings us to our next story, which is very resonant with our earlier email from Carrie. I'm not going to read the whole story, but I like the way that they begin this. You know, in journalism, they tell you always start with a human interest story. So you're in Winterset, Iowa. Mackenzie Dryden's happiest childhood memories are of running barefoot through the sunlit cornfields of her hometown. But when she was diagnosed with cancer 2.5 years ago at 18, a disturbing thought began to take hold. Could something in the land she loved have made her sick? Dryden went to social media for answers and stumbled upon a deeper mystery. In just 2 years, 4 other recent graduates from her high school, home to only 500 students, had also been diagnosed with advanced cancers. Cancer rates among young adults in the Corn Belt, a patchwork of fields stretching through the heart of the Midwest, are rising more rapidly than in the country as a whole, a recent Washington Post data analysis revealed. The 6 leading states for corn production are Iowa, Nebraska, Illinois, Minnesota, Indiana, and Kansas. And when they started doing state-level tracking back in 1999, they had the same cancer frequency for young adults and for the overall population. In the early 2000s, they began to diverge a little. And since 2015, these states have had significantly higher cancer rates among those aged 15 to 49. So let's think about 15 to 49. All right. So that's where we're talking birthdays in the 80s. So in the latest data from 2022, those states have a rate 5% higher for young adults and 5% higher for the overall overall population. And this is cancer across the board, not just colon cancer. Although colon cancer, as we've talked about on earlier shows, is one of the cancers that has really blossomed in terms of cancer rates and also severity of the cancers. There were also the cancers in the Midwestern states we're talking about are especially kidney and skin cancers. Skin cancer risk for young adults, 66% higher for women than their peers in other states. Something is going on. When we think about our new Health and Human Services, there has been an actual willingness to acknowledge environmental exposure and diet as risk factors for chronic diseases. And At least in some of the red states, they're paying attention. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds this year announced a $1 million investment to establish a research team dedicated to investigating the underlying causes of the state's growing cancer rates. And pesticide manufacturer Bayer recently faced a setback in the state legislature when a proposed bill intended to protect the company from lawsuits claiming that its flagship product Roundup causes cancer was defeated. Oh, and let me just tell you that they took the glyphosate out of Roundup last year, and they put in something even worse. But it's not glyphosate, so they'll be able to keep. Presumably, people will say, "Oh, they changed it, and now it must be better." Well, absence of evidence is not the same thing as evidence of absence, and in terms of Ames testing. Ames testing is a way of looking to see how easily a substance mutates cells. And if it's in a high mutation rate, then you assume it's going to be a high cancer rate. And Ames testing for the new ingredient, which I believe starts with a D, I don't have a chance to look that up right now, but you can just look up Roundup and look at the ingredients, and it's right there. These changes are really startling. And the question is, what's causing it? A lot of fingers are pointing at Roundup. The EPA has changed. Well, it's disagreeing with the World Health Organization, which has deemed it probably carcinogenic, and has reaffirmed its belief that it's not likely to be carcinogenic. They are probably not going to change their plans. There have been a lot of lawsuits, but lawsuits aren't science, and there's a lot that goes into proving things in science. And maybe the data there is mainly in animals, and it's awfully hard to prove things in humans. Without going into further detail, let me just say that something has shifted in the environment or in our food supply. And going back to a healthier diet, I have an article here. I probably won't get to it today, but next week we'll be talking about microplastics and their impact on us, and also some new strategies for possibly getting rid of them. We've got time for that last email. This from Elizabeth, and Elizabeth sent me a JAMA article. That was a JAMA article about lithium and Alzheimer's disease. This article is very technical, so I'm going to just tell you that I spent about 10 minutes poring over the diagram trying to understand exactly what was going on here. I'll just read the abstract and stop and explain things. So, disruption of intracellular calcium homeostasis plays an important role as an upstream pathway in Alzheimer's disease. Calcium is typically going through a calcium-gated receptor called NMDA. And one of our drugs, Namenda, wonder where they got that name, affects that receptor, and it's probably the best drug we have for mitigating Alzheimer's symptoms and helping people think a little bit more clearly. Correction of calcium dysregulation has been increasingly proposed as a target of future effective disease-modified drugs for treating Alzheimer's. Clinically available drugs that can inhibit the disturbed calcium 2 homeostasis have been repurposed to treat COVID-19 patients. This narrative aims at exploring the underlying mechanism by which lithium, a first-line drug for the treatment of bipolar disease, inhibits calcium dysregulation and associated downstream pathology in both Alzheimer's disease and COVID-19. The article goes on to suggest that lithium can reset these deranged calcium gates and therefore inhibit the adverse events which lead to damage of the mitochondria and production of tau protein. And we now understand that tau protein is really the culprit in Alzheimer's disease in terms of a cause. The amyloid beta is more of a symptom, but so taking it away doesn't get to the core problem. But going after tau does seem to be a pathway to potential cure, and certainly reducing the amount of tau that's being made allows the autophagy, the waste elimination functions in the neurons, to function more efficiently and get rid of some of the waste, get on top of the pile, if you will, and start reducing it rather than just being sinking deeper and deeper while shoveling as fast as it can. So very good news there. And a couple more good news stories for you. There's been a dramatic drop in peanut allergies. As you may recall, that's one of the most common and dangerous childhood food allergies, but they are on the decline. In 2017, the American Pediatric Association made recommendations saying that babies should be given peanuts at 4 to 6 months, and that this was introduced in the wake of a landmark study called Learning Early About Peanut Allergy Trial, LEAP, and it showed that early exposure of the nut could reduce allergies by more than 80%. So that was real science. where they had two groups and they prospectively assigned people to the groups and then did the peanut exposure. For this new study, it was a looking back, looked at the case records from about 120 children under age three. And in 2015, about almost 1%, 0.79% of children had peanut allergies. But by between 2017 and 2020, it dropped to only 0.45%. And overall, all food allergies declined by 36%. So we need more research. But I think as a proof principle, exposing children to healthy food foods early and a broad variety of foods is a good idea. It's monoculture that causes allergies. The other studies I could bring to your attention would be one that showed that feeding the pregnant moms peanuts while they were pregnant reduced the risk of peanut allergy in the offspring, probably because there was exposure and that led the system to recognize that as just an innocent bystander and not something that the immune system needed to attack. And I have only a short story about this, but I am very excited and we'll try to find more detail. This was a landmark breakthrough. Researchers have perfected a wireless retinal implant that can be used to treat age-related macular degeneration. This is also called geographic atrophy. So this prosthetic device is actually placed in the retina and it talks through Bluetooth, I guess, or some sort of communication. So a person wears glasses with a camera mounted on them. The image in the camera is converted to near-infrared signals that are projected onto a chip in the eye. So these signals stimulate the surviving retinal neurons, and it allows people to see blurry black and white images. So participants improved by two lines on a standard eye chart. It takes a little bit of time and training to use the implant and glasses, but the rewards are worth the effort. This allows people to see the expression on faces of people in the room. It allows them to read smaller print. It allows them to have a broader range of vision, let's say. And since we have nothing that reverses macular degeneration and there is already a higher resolution device, remember this is just a prototype, but it works. So I think they've finally nailed the technology and they showed that it wasn't that big a deal to put it in there. They did have some retinal tears, but those resolved within a couple of months. And obviously, they're learning how to do this. And let me tell you, when you do something for the 5,000th time, you're pretty slick doing it, as opposed to when it's a new device and you're sort of feeling your way. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.